You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It wasn't until the 1980s that objections to South Africa's apartheid system became an issue with mainstream America. But decades before, in the late 1950s, Lionel Rogozin, a self-taught American filmmaker, captured the stark reality of life in that country in a film he called Come Back Africa. It was cast with non-actors and secretly documented the awful conditions residents of Sophiatown, a black area of Johannesburg, lived in. It's been restored recently, and the new print is being screened at the Film Forum on West Houston Street. Joining us now to discuss it are activist, actor, and musician Harry Belafonte, actor, writer, and film director Robert Downey Sr., and Lionel Rogozin's son Michael, who is a filmmaker in his own right. He's recently released An American in Sophiatown, a look at the making of his father's film, and I'm very pleased to welcome all of you to our show. Hi.
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 Harry, how aware were you? Hi, Michael. Where, Michael, you're in right now, you're in Paris? I feel so sorry for you.
I'm in France.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I won't be there for this very exciting screening tonight, but I'm sure everyone who goes will have a great evening. So,
well, let's begin with you, Harry. How aware were you of the political and social climate in South Africa and what life was like for blacks in the late 1950s and early 1960s when this film was made?
Well, I was very much aware of it before the film was made. And my whole relationship to left-wing politics kept me highly informed about the emergence of struggles all throughout Africa and Asia and other places, which were mirrored by our own struggles here in the United States. And we found a great deal of commonality in some of the objectives that different groups had set for themselves. And for me, the whole world of culture most attracted me was the culture that sought to delve into the lives of people caught in these kinds of struggles. And as much as I knew about Africa and as much as I'd learned about Africa through people like Paul Robeson and Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, who were the great intellectuals of the day on the subject and had friends, it wasn't until I saw Come Back Africa, Lionel Rogozin's film, that I really felt the most powerful impact of what that system was really about. And it was, I call, the real beacon of truth that guided a lot of us to know that society and how cruel it was.
Michael, could you tell us a little bit about your father's background? Hadn't he worked as a chemical engineer for his father before he decided to become a filmmaker?
Well, he had. He always had the ambition to, I think, leave the company relatively soon, but he struggled to find out what his voice would be. And I think he considered several options, journalism or other things, and he figured that what he had most talent for would be filmmaking. And, of course, we're talking about Come Back Africa today, but he had already done On the Bowery. What we discovered in this research for things that we didn't even know, since my father didn't tell us everything, was how adamant he was about exposing the apartheid regime. And he made the film in 58, but he had the idea in 48, just after the war, since he was extremely affected by the war. And he made a vow to fight fascism and racism. And one thing I'd like to say about it also from the research, my father really made considered fascism and racism extremely connected. I think that was one of the major themes how we consider, you know, in the world. And so when he saw the situation in South Africa in 48, said that has to be stopped. And then he took quite a while from leaving the company and then making his first film to be able to go to South Africa and make the film under conditions, secretive conditions, obviously.
Well, he made On the Bowery, which is also quite remarkable, as a way to learn filmmaking. He wound up making a pretty incredible film just as an education piece. Why do you think he picked the Bowery as a place to gain that experience?
Well, that's what he claimed, and from the interviews we have with him, I suspect that there were other motivations. You know, we have to analyze this unconsciously how an artist works. I think he was deeply attracted to the men, and it was kind of a symbol for what was happening in America. He was extremely politically aware, so the fact that he did On the Bowery was not an accident. and he thought it was a, I think originally it started going to be a short piece, and then it became a longer piece. The making of On the Bowery is an incredible story because, you know, it's the encounters that he made during that time, finding what I call the perfect team of amazing people like Richard Bagley, who was a great cameraman, that the film developed as something really important. His intention really was to learn to make a film, and he had limited experience. He had a little experience before. He shot himself with 16mm, but it was his first real project. With the goal, as we say, which we found out, of going to South Africa later on and having the technical capacity and experience to be able to make a film under these conditions.
Well, Robert Downey Sr., Rogozin is credited with pioneering a form of filmmaking. What made his style, both in On the Bowery and Comeback Africa, so original? They're not documentaries. They're not straight documentaries, although they use many documentary techniques.
Well, because he broke the rules because he had to.
He was influenced by
Flaherty.
By Flaherty and the Italian neorealists, especially Vittorio De Sica. And he was doing something similar in that he was showing real life but using amateur actors.
Yeah. The thing about Lionel that nobody talks about is he was very funny. He's one of the funniest characters I've known, and most people don't know that about him.
But that
it's hard to believe.
Well, it doesn't. There are some funny moments in these films, but then we wouldn't call them comedies. Many films have mixed fiction and nonfiction. Since we have Michael Romer's Nothing But a Man, Kent McKenzie's The Exiles, Shirley Clarke's The Cool World, Charles Burnett's Killer of Sheep. Would we say that he was pretty much the pioneer of that style?
Yeah, I agree.
What about when you began your career as an underground filmmaker? Was Comeback Africa an influence?
Yeah, I liked it, but I was more hooked into Lionel because of his theater, and he opened a couple of my films there, and he loved to help other filmmakers.
The Bleecker Street Cinema.
Yeah.
Now, he opened the Bleecker Street Cinema, Michael, because he couldn't get anybody to show On the Bowery?
Right.
I'd like to make the observation that Lionel Rogerson's choice for the Bowery and of Comeback Africa is no coincidence. I think there's an edge to life. There's a rawness to life. There's a rawness to the drama of the human experience in those environments that I think attracted him. And I think that to find an actor to play those parts that became the featured faces in all of his films, would have been for him to falsify the environment and to get people who were non-actors, who were part of the environment, was a big part of his artistry and a big part of how he was able to bring us imagery that I don't think we would have been as touched by had these films been cast with known faces and trained actors.
But he's also making films about victims of society. Whether they're victims of American capitalism or victims of the South African
apartheid regime. Yes, it's about oppression.
But I was asking you, did he open the Bleecker Street to be able to show On the Bowery? Because Bosley Crowther gave it a ridiculously stupid review.
It was interesting because I think it's very true. And my father was very affected by faces, which you see in the films. And the two main actors in both On the Bowery and in Comeback Africa, but they're not actors, but people who are living their life, whatever, are very touching because they are living their real story. And he had the eye of picking the face and having come some kind of instinct to picking the right people. So I definitely would agree with that.
Hollywood came after the guy in On the Bowery. Hollywood came after the guy in On the Bowery, tried to get him as an actor.
Right, right.
I mean, the guy died before he...
Now it's one of the landmark films listed in the National Film Registry, considering how hard it was to get it screened. Now it's considered one of the great films of all time.
Exactly.
Well, to answer the question about the Bleecker Street Cinema, he opened Comeback Africa there. He had a lot of difficulty distributing On the Bowery, obviously, and that continued with Comeback Africa. The Bleecker Street was founded with the idea that the American independents needed a place to show their films, and apparently it was very difficult and expensive to open a film at that time. So he had that in mind, and he started with Comeback Africa, and then there's a lot of stories about the Bleecker Street that Bob could tell you. It was quite an incredible place. But it was originally the first. The opening was for Comeback Africa.
And we're talking with Lionel Rogerson's son, Michael Rogerson. And we're very lucky to also have Harry Belafonte and Robert Downey Sr. here today, not to discuss their own work, but to discuss Lionel Rogerson's groundbreaking film, Comeback Africa, which opens for a two-week run at the Film Forum on West Houston Street tonight. Although, Harry, we should point out that as long as we're talking about films, Sing Your Song, a documentary about your life that was directed by Suzanne Rostock, is currently being shown at the Independent Film Center on 6th Avenue, the IFC.
It was 4th, yeah, IFC.
Mary McCabe is in that film, and she's in Comeback Africa.
Well, thanks to the generosity of the distributors for Comeback Africa, we were given permission to use a sequence or two from that film to tell the story of my own journey in the arts. And I think that that film was an epiphany in many ways for me. It was the quintessential moment when I saw the capacity to use the culture of Africa in its authentic state to be able to influence the thoughts of people in America who were so distant from any information on the continent. No film that I had seen had quite the impact of bringing across the political and social sensibilities of the experiences that people are having in South Africa and other places like it, as did that film. And being able to see it under the conditions which I accidentally came to see it. And then,
such as? What happened?
Well, I was in London and performing, and opening night, I'd gotten back to the hotel fairly late because we had an after-party celebration, stuff that, you know, showbiz. And when I got to the hotel, the concierge of the hotel told me that there had been a priest who was there waiting to see me for quite a number of hours. And when I went over to see this priest sitting in the lobby, he had with him three young men from Africa. And it was kind of late in the morning or early in the morning, 2 o'clock. And he said, "I'm sorry to interrupt and to disturb you, but..." And then he went on to tell me the story about how these young men had just come from the Venice Film Festival, where Comeback Africa had been entered in competition and had won astounding response and awards and whatnot for its accomplishments. That when the South African government got wind of this fact that there was this film that was so powerfully responded to by the international community, and it was a film that so thoroughly condemned the apartheid condition, they went into absolute orbit. They threatened these artists and these people who had attended with life in prison. It was terrible. And these young men and a young woman was there looking for a political asylum. They had come from Venice to London, and they were in a bind because their visa was very limited. And just a matter of a week or so, they'd all be released to go and have to go back to South Africa. And he was appealing to me because of my relationship to so many people in England, especially in the political arena, that I might be able to intervene and get them a temporary visa to last a little bit longer.
Were you able to?
Yes, but not before I saw the film, because I said, well, I need to see this film to become more articulate if I'm to champion your cause. So the very next day, they set up a little place down in the film district of London, and I saw the film. And in the film, I saw this young woman who turned out to be Miriam McCabe. And just as Not yet famous. Well, she was famous in South Africa because she'd done quite a number of plays and things, and she was loved by a lot of the black South African people. Well, I can't even make that delineation. I'm not too sure that there weren't a lot of white folks that liked her as well. Her art was truly universal. And when those people escaping from coming from Venice, escaping from South Africa, I met with them all and I saw Miriam. She told me that Lionel Rogerson and others had already invited her to come to America, and she was coming. And And I said, well, when you get to the United States, I would like to come visit you. And it turned out that she was right in the midst of my own cultural interest, because she was brought also by a guy named Max Gordon, mm-hmm. who ran for a long time the Village Vanguard. And he and Lionel had partnered in helping to bring her here. And I went down to see her, and that's how it all started.
Now, I suspect that, Robert, that your first time seeing this film was a lot less dramatic. Happened to show up at the Bleecker Street, and there it was?
Yeah, exactly.
But knocked out, I'm sure.
Well, I'd never seen anything like it.
Well, we have to take a little break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how this film was made, because it had to be made secretly, and people's lives were endangered in the process. My guests are Michael Rogerson, the son of Lionel Rogerson, who made Come Back Africa, and Harry Belafonte and Robert Downey Sr., two big fans of the film, which opens today for a two-week run at the Film Forum on West Houston Street. Stay with us. We are back. Michael Rogerson, the son of Lionel Rogerson, the filmmaker of Come Back Africa, among other films, the founder of the late lamented Bleecker Street Cinema, and with Harry Belafonte, Robert Downey Sr., two people who love this film and want to support it in any way they can. Well, let's talk about what happened, Michael. Did your father ever consider making a straight documentary about life under apartheid?
No, I don't think so, because his style and method was not a straight documentary with a narration, or in his whole style was a style of which had a dramatic content, and you know, was coming out, as you said before, out of Flaherty and De Sica. Of course, De Sica had a political angle, but my father is, of course, extremely influenced by the political side of it. So, though he did have the objective of showing life, it is. And as we see in Come Back Africa, his idea was to give the voice to the people who were there, not to impose his own ideas. And it's probably, as far as I know from the specialists in African history, the first time we're giving Africans their own voice. Because in South Africa, up to Come Back Africa, you had your typical musical comedies and things like that.
Well, they had been Cry of the Beloved Country, but that was an exception.
Right.
And that got some of the people involved into a lot of political problems, trouble right here. Canada Lee, the star, wound up having to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee. So it was kind of dangerous to do this sort of thing at that time.
Well, Sidney Poitier, who also was in the film with Canada Lee, could not even get his passport to go to South Africa because the government had very strong restrictions. As a matter of fact, the way he got in was he had to go in as an indentured servant to Alexander Korda. He could only go in as his servant, his male butler, to get into South Africa.
The things we learn on this show, that's fascinating. Well, so, but in your father's case, how did he get past the authorities? They would want to know what he was going to do, would want to see a script. Did he give him some kind of script?
It's rather funny in a way. He had all kinds of stories, which obviously is a dangerous thing to do, which changed as they went along. I think it was either a travel log, a musical, and it was relatively dangerous because he did have publicity because of On the Bowery. And then he would change his story. I think he came up with a story about the one of the Boer historical events. But somehow he had his own theory, which we learned about afterwards, was that he thought that he was protected in some way because he thought that the authorities would never thought a white person would come and expose things, that it was beyond their comprehension because they were so into their closed-minded attitude towards things. So I think he was actually right to some degree. But so he did have the stories that changed, as I say. And I think there was one very, very risky moment when he was called in by the head of the Secret Service, whatever. But he managed to talk his way through it. And he had an alternative plan that if he was caught, that he would go across the border and try to finish. But, of course, that's really not what he wanted to do. And they would develop the film in South Africa and ship it out. My mother brought it to the airport every day and shipped it out. And that's also a kind of funny story because the laboratory that developed it didn't really look at it. And he kind of made these kind of judgments ahead of time, these kind of theories about how people would react. And he was most usually right. He figured that the technicians who were looking at it wouldn't really look at it. They'd kind of see basically what was, you know, the contrast or whatever, and that they would probably be more interested in having the work than to be involved. And I think that's what happened. So he managed to get away with it until the very end. Until the very end, once he left the country, the cameraman was found out and was taken by two secret service men to the airport, escorted, and sent out of the country. So.
And you tell that story in your film because what happened was your father was here editing the film and he started talking about it and the South African government noticed that he was getting reshoots of some scenes done by the cameraman and they arrested the cameraman. So, but what about, and Harry talked about some of the cast members who looked for asylum. So there were repercussions.
Well, I was fascinated to hear Mr. Belafonte's story, which I'd never heard before, so that was a real pleasure, part of the history that I didn't know about. So we should document that at some point. Yes, I don't know. The film was banned in South Africa, so, you know, a lot of people left. You know, Miriam left, Blok Madisani, who was one of the writers in the film, Louis Nkosi, who died last year, unfortunately, left the country relatively soon afterwards.
Who played Zachariah?
Zachariah. Now, unfortunately, Zachariah, that was his name?
Yeah.
I don't recall. He was a dental assistant. And my father found him in a train station and saw that face. And he went up to him and said, with Bloke, who was with him, and I think Zachariah was quite scared, you know, because you had, you know, people going up to you then. It was quite dangerous. And they calmed him down, said, it's okay, we want to talk to you, and this and that. And they hit it right on. I don't know. It was really gut instinct. And, of course, Zachariah is absolutely amazing. He'd never acted before. And he's able to transmit the whole, you know, synthesis of whatever the culture was going through, life that they were having to deal with. So
he has. I don't want to go into
what happened to Zachariah. We were never able to trace. I was back to South Africa a few times with Louis Nkosi. We were, unfortunately, never able to really trace what happened to the people there. We know what happened to many of the people, the intellectuals and musicians who left. We did discover recently that one of the Penny Whistlers actually became quite famous, Lenny, and played with Paul Simon. And so, but besides a lot of the people, Hazel, who's in the film, we weren't able to trace that many years later because we were only able to go back to revise and search for people in 2000, after 2004 or 5, so it was quite late. So,
My guess is Michael Rogerson.
They probably died young.
Michael Rogerson is the son of Lionel Rogerson, who made On the Bowery and Come Back Africa. We're talking about Come Back Africa, which has just been restored, and there's a gorgeous new print of it that is being shown for the next 2 weeks at the Film Forum on West Houston Street. Also with us are Robert Downey Sr. and Harry Belafonte, two admirers of the film, and I'm very pleased that they agreed to join us to also tell us about how great it is. It's one thing for me to talk to the son of the filmmaker, and we all agree that it's a terrific film. It's another thing to bring you men in here and have you also tell us just how much you admire this film. There were a lot of things in it that that were startling at the time. Well, first of all, because much of it was improvised. There's a scene where one of the central characters says, and I'm paraphrasing, if I could sit with my worst enemy over a bottle of beer, maybe we could get to know each other. It's a matter of understanding each other and how we can live in the world together. What's wrong with different kinds of people getting together? A basic frustration that I'm sure many South African blacks felt because of the separation. Do we know whatever happened to that man, Cam Themba?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, you know, in that scene, which is the scene, the intellectual discussion, before Miriam comes in, then she comes in and it kind of fizzles out, they keep going. It's an incredible moment to me. I've seen it many times, And I have to say, every time I see Combat Africa, I see something new. And that scene is something, scene that many people talk about, because you come out of the story of Zachariah and his life, and here you're kind of going on to a philosophical meeting, which was actually in the Shebeen, as people know, it's the only meeting place where blacks could meet and talk about politics and enjoy music. So we're seeing a slice of life from Sophiatown at that time as it was. But not only that, but the people in that scene are actually all writers and important intellectuals of South Africa who were living under very difficult conditions but were brilliant people. And Ken Tembo, who you mentioned, was a great writer. They all wrote for a magazine that was called Drum Magazine. And so we're seeing these writers in their real context talking about their real lives. So it's really an amazing moment to me. Ken Tembo, of course, in those days, and, you know, a lot of people drank, so there's a lot of drinking going on. I think Ken Tembo had a rather tragic death. He didn't leave South Africa. He continued. He's known as an important writer there. And he died very young, I think, you know. I don't know how many years after the film. So this is the only document with these people, with these writers. And, that's a scene that many people talk about. It's one of the most important scenes in the film. And then, of course, the fantastic entrance of Miriam when she was so young. That is so moving as well.
It's easy for us
at the end of the scene.
It's easy for us to feel a bit superior to all of this. But yesterday I was speaking to Petula Clark about something that happened with you, Harry, on television here, where she touched your arm, and they wanted to cut that out of the show because they felt, and this was already in the 60s, wasn't it?
Yes, quite late in the 60s, and we had sung a song that she had written, and some of the camera moves were quite bothersome, and when we finally got the take that we liked, when we got to the very end of the song, partly in a sense of triumph that we'd conquered the problem and that we'd done so well, she just gently reached out and touched me on my elbow and rested her hand there for all of 5 seconds. And when the take was completed, we waited to be dismissed to go get set up for the next take. And we were told from the producer's booth that the take was unacceptable. And when we tried to figure out what it is that we did wrong, it turned out that the account exec for the product that sponsored the show, of Plymouth, the particular division of Chrysler, and this guy named Doyle Lott went into orbit that Petula Clark touched my elbow, and the insidiousness of that thought so overwhelmed us that we couldn't understand what they were talking about. And they wanted to reshoot it.
But and you wouldn't do it.
And what was important, it was very critical to Pet Clark, because this was her first big shot on American television, her own show, and for her to go up against the system by refusing to reshoot the scene meant that she put it all on the line. And she was just so courageous and just said, nope. It stays as it is.
It all seems so stupid today. We see children performing a lot of music on the streets. Was it your sense that this was one of the ways that people could release emotions in this kind of repressive environment?
Which was the...
Well, the kids are performing constantly throughout the film. We get a lot of music.
On the street.
On the
oh,
streets.
Yes, yes.
Now,
Michael,
yes, yes. Has Come Back Africa been shown in South Africa? Ever?
It was banned for quite a long time. It was shown clandestinely at some point, I think in the 80s or 90s. And then until the restoration, it was Come Back Africa wasn't seen for many, many years. Still not shown on American television today. In South Africa, we was shown at the Sitangi Festival after it was restored by the Cineteca di Bologna in 2005. So it did have some screenings there. We have not had the reception yet that needs to happen, and I think it's partially because my feeling is that in South Africa they don't want to look at the most painful moments of that period. They would kind of push it aside and let's move on to something else. So,
but why has it never been shown in American television? Have you tried to have it shown on public television at least? On Turner Classic Movies?
A long story. I think ask Bob. Maybe he would know more than I do. That's a whole question of independent filmmakers in America and public support and all kinds of things. So it's a complicated question. I think that it will be solved because Milestone, who's our distributors, are doing a fantastic job. So I think something will happen in the future. But it's been a long time. It's over 50 years. So that's a long time to wait.
Bob, you have any theories?
I know that a couple of my films ended up on Turner Classics at 2 in the morning 2 years ago. That was it. So people, too many people were up at that hour who left me.
I think we have to demystify this whole thing on race. I think the question is raised by Spike Lee a little awkwardly at the last Sundance Festival, I think is right on the money. But there's a thing called selected racism. And I think that Comeback Africa suffers from that.
Comeback Africa can be seen at the Film Forum now and the next 2 weeks in a brand new, fabulous print. And my great thanks to Michael Rogerson, son of its filmmaker, and Harry Belafonte and Robert Downey Sr. for being on our show today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you all.
I'm so happy that you gave us this opportunity to push this film. It's one of the most important films ever made in the cinema industry.